Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Hornsby. I think that this is going to be a big year in 2024 for student loans. I thought I would just talk about that a little bit for today's episode, maybe keep it a little bit short and sweet. Administrative forbearance is obviously a really big thing that's going on right now. We're going to talk about administrative forbearance. We're going to talk about recertification of your income, which for many people is coming way too soon. We're going to talk about what we might see in the spring and early summer as the election heats up for the 2024 presidential election, and then what might happen depending on who wins that election. First off, I want to start about the administrative forbearance going on right now for a lot of people. Supposedly, I don't know if we can truly believe these are the accurate numbers, but supposedly there are 3.5 million people on administrative forbearance as of the time I recorded this. That's what the Department of Education says, what the White House says. The true number could easily be much larger than that because we don't truly know how many people are actually on administrative forbearance. Like that's like the number of people that were instructed to be placed on that status by the Department of Education. The reality is this administrative forbearance thing is really tricky because it's sort of like a, because I said so, we made the rules up kind of a program versus something that's like very specifically defined. They are using the higher education waive and cancel authority, which is the like biggest fight that Democrats and Republicans have about student loans, is what exactly that compromise and settle authority truly means. But they are using that same authority that Democrats argue gives them the power to cancel all student loan debt at once. That's really interesting, right? Because this is sort of like a world where the White House and Department of Education can kind of just say, well, the rules are what we say they are, versus something like the income-based repayment program, which is literally defined in a congressional statute and cannot just be gotten rid of whenever somebody wants, right? So with student loans, there's a lot of like nuances with the policy, right? There's programs that are written into law. It would take 60 senators to overturn it, which is basically never going to happen, right? Unless you junk the filibuster, but that's unlikely going to happen with the composition of the Senate, with some of the swing Senate votes that wouldn't currently support that, right? So that means you probably need 60 votes in the Senate to get rid of something like the income-based repayment program. Now, in contrast, the Saving on a Valuable Education program was done solely through executive authority. That means if you have a Republican win in 2024, let's say the Republican is Trump, I'm not so convinced that he will care enough to initiate negotiated rulemaking to overturn the SAVE plan. In the unlikely event that it was somebody else that was a Republican, I think they very much would. I think that'd be one of the first things they would do is try to reverse most of the things Biden has done on a looking forward basis, not a backward looking basis with student loan reforms that he's done. So meaning like the adjustments on the IDR waiver, PSLF waiver, the forgiveness that's happened, that would stay around. The updated payment counts, that would stay around. I'm just talking about stuff in the future. Let's just go maybe chronological for this. So the administrative forbearance, you've got that really could come up at any time. So it seems like some of the servicers have said January, but to me, that's like a placeholder. They could push it whenever they want for whatever reason they want. MOHELA is the biggest offender here. So based off of some of the survey data we've done, based on some of the things we've seen, it seems like Advantage is number two in the worst offender status and Nelnet's number three. What they're doing is it seems like some people that have applied for SAVE are getting this administrative forbearance. Some people on different plans have, and some people are not at all. The White House kind of said after the fact, like a couple months after these servicers started messing this up and putting people into administrative forbearance, the White House came out and clarified, hey, this is, I guess technically it was Department of Ed, clarified that, hey, this administrative forbearance is going to count towards forgiveness, even though you're not making payments, and any interest that would have accrued is going to be retroactively wiped away because you could have been on the SAVE plan paying $0 a month. That means that we want to not hurt anybody, and how, you know, they usually do things for student loans in the Biden administration is we want to make sure that people that would have really been hurt are not hurt, but we're going to just use the broad brush of helping everybody, even though it only would have affected, you know, maybe it would have been a lot, like maybe half of the people in administrative forbearance could have gotten a $0 payment. So, you know, there's definitely a good argument for just waiving all the interest for it. It's kind of like a backdoor continuation of the student loan pause, though. And I think eventually servicers are going to get everybody back into repayment because that's what they're supposed to do. Eventually, Republicans will refocus from their season of chaos over who was going to be the speaker to realize that the Biden administration is pulling a fast one on them like they usually do in student loan policy. Democrats are way more organized and frankly smart on getting policy aims achieved than Republicans are. And so I think most people will be out of administrative forbearance if you're on one, maybe like February, March. Some people in January. Now, what about the income-driven recertification situation? So that's something that we're seeing a whole lot of right now. a lot of people are getting messages from their servicers telling them they have to recertify before March 1, which is not legal, according to guidance from the Department of Ed. Now, remember, this is not a statutory thing. This is not something written in law. Department of Ed said, because hashtag vibes, we don't want anybody to have to recertify before March 1st, and we're going to kick out anybody that was before that date a full year before they have to recertify. Now, that's what they've literally said in like press releases and statements and things like that. And federal student aid does have a ton of power with the servicers to tell them what to do on things like this. But the thing is it's not something that's like a specific law or even regulatory, like officially made regulatory rule. Servicers are kind of having to operate based off of, hey, Department of Ed, what should we do? And Department of Ed usually rules by, you know, they issue a press release. They say what they're going to do. And then the servicers find out about it later, and the servicers don't have that much money compared to what they need to do the job well. And so the servicers are scrambling to try to do things, and that's how we ended up with this administrative forbearance. Now, the funny thing is it benefited a lot of people. The fact that servicers don't have enough money to do their jobs, in some ways, especially given all the stuff that's happened with the IDR waiver, PSLF waiver, et cetera, in some ways, that's actually saved people money. It's kind of perverse to think about it, but let's say that you were not forbearance steered by a servicer. Let's say that you were not put into deferment incorrectly during residency, right? And you were asked to make those payments because the servicers had money to do their jobs. Then you would have had more money out of your pocket because you would have had to pay the loans. So I get the frustration. It's very warranted. It's justifiable. You have every right to be upset with how ridiculous the servicers are. I'm just saying, you know, try to look at the glass half full instead of glass half empty, because if you look at glass half empty in the student loan world, you'll just be depressed all the time. Nobody wants that. So administrative forbearance, probably wrapping up January, February, March, and then IDR recertification. So just to let you know here, if you were asked to make payments, you know, and you were in an administrative forbearance, you can also get a refund still. So you can actually call your servicer and ask for a refund probably up until the early spring for any payments you made since student loan started again and until the administrative forbearance ends. This is what we think is going on right now. So just in case, you know, you had a bunch of payments auto-debited from your account and then you found out that payment was wrong and you called your servicer and the servicer said, we're just going to put you on an administrative forbearance, you can get that money back, which could be thousands of dollars if you just message or call them. So a little hack there. In terms of the administrative forbearance leading into the recertification of income, remember what I said, nobody will be forced to recertify until March 1. If it's before that date, it's supposed to get kicked out a full year. So if your recertification date is February 2024, it should go out to February 2025. There's a couple exceptions to this. If you were not on an income-based plan before COVID, you recertified possibly during the pandemic, that could be a little gray area. Somebody might still want you to recertify in that case. I think you still have an argument for asking them to delay that recertification, but just know that. If you've never signed up to certify your income for an IDR plan, that might be a scenario where you're asked to certify your income earlier than March 2024. That could be a way to save a whole lot of money. Now, when you have to certify in 2024, who knows if this loophole will last long term, because we're in the early days of connections of the IRS to your student aid file that determines all the IDR payments. But let's say that your recertification date is July 2024. You might file for an extension on your income taxes if you have a ability to do so, if your income is significantly higher this past tax year than it was the prior tax year, and you get a lower payment, right? More subsidies if you're on the SAVE plan, lower payments, which gets you more forgiveness if you're, you know, on pay or SAVE going for forgiveness. So that's a pretty cool strategy. The catch is you do have to pay your monthly payments or your total tax bill due by the actual due date of April, but you can extend that filing deadline all the way to October if you file for an extension, which a tax professional can help you do. We actually help people do that. I think we're fairly full for this tax season, but we might share ways to get that help if you really desperately needed it in another pod or something like that. When you're recertifying income in early spring, that'll start happening. Another fun fact to know, you can self-certify your income until October 2024. This is a little bit hilarious to me because I'm not at all suggesting that you ever lie to the federal government. It's a bad call. Don't do it. But what is literally possible right now is you could call up your servicer and just say, I make, you know, put your finger to the wind, $50,000 a year. And the servicer says, okay, here's your monthly payment. What a terrible system. But the servicers have no resources. They want people to sign up for IDR plans. they want to lower the barriers as much as possible. So this is the world we're living in. So what does that mean for somebody? Well, you know, if you are a business owner, or if you have uncertain income, or if your income's been up and down a whole lot, I think it's defendable to call them and self-certify and save yourself a bit of paperwork. And I really do mean to tell the truth. It's the right thing to do. It's the right policy. As long as you always try to tell the truth, things tend to work themselves out. So definitely tell the truth, but also you might truthfully be able to use that to your advantage by calling them and just doing your best guess of the estimate of your income, what it will be after all the deductions, after all the write-offs, etc. But that ends in October. So you can self-certify your income until October, and then you've got to document it, right? Which means alternative documentation of income, filing tax returns and connecting tax returns directly to your FSA profile by giving IRS permission to share data, et cetera. April 30th, the IDR waiver expires. It's unlikely that that IDR waiver is actually going to expire, because that would mean that there's a period of time, April 30th to July 1st, where you neither get credit for the loan with the oldest amount of credit on it, or you also don't get weighted average credit when you consolidate. So theoretically, as of this moment, April 30th to July 1, you would get no credit for a consolidation on prior months of payments, which shows how ridiculous this is. It's just a sort of gamesmanship to extend it to April 30th. They just didn't want to extend it probably fully to June 30th, because I think they wanted to, again, force as many people as possible to take action by April 30th and then extend it again in the last second so they can spread out the number of people that they're going to have to work to update their payment accounts for, instead of having it all due at a certain date. So if they said June 30th, everybody would wait until June 30th to consolidate, then they would have all of the work to do in June 30th while they're also trying to elevate the new save plan rules, which go into effect July 1. Those rules are going to be that you can pay 5% of your income on undergrad loans only, and a weighted average between 5 and 10% depending on your mix of undergrad and grad loans. This is going to open up a lot of people needing student loan advice, I think, because say you are a corporate employee making 60 grand a year with 30K of debt. And let's say you're married and you have two kids. So your family size for the 225% of the poverty line, your family size would be three there. Your deduction would be about 55,000. So you're making 60, deduction's 55,000. So of the $5,000 that is the difference, take 5% of that. So it's $250 a year. It's about $20 a month. So if you're paying $250 a year for 20 years, that's what, $5,000, I guess? So you're talking paying $5,000 for a $30,000 balance. This math could also work even if you delay getting married. So if you graduate, you're 22, you know, you take some time off, you do gap year or whatever, you're in between jobs, right? There's all kinds of ways to legally game the system and get low payments on save or IDR plans and get a low enough payment that by the time you do get married and have a couple kids, now you're 225% of the poverty line's much larger. And you're able to possibly file taxes separately, do things with retirement accounts, do other types of investment strategies to get your AGI lower, and continually be paying very low amounts of money on your student loans and not have to pay it off. Is this good? Should you do this? Well, think about, like, if you're paying your student loans off, a 30K balance, you have to pay $300 a month. That's after-tax dollars. So in terms of pre-tax dollars, you're probably paying more like $500 a month, which is $6,000. That's a fully funded Roth IRA, traditional IRA, I guess, if we're doing pre-tax money. But imagine doing a fully funded traditional IRA for 10 years. That's what the equivalent is. So, you know, you would have maybe, what, 70,000 plus investment gains. You could have like $100,000, $120,000, something like that in retirement instead of paying down your $30,000 student loan balance. So this is going to change the game for how a lot of people do things. I mean, employers are going to be caught off guard with this, because all the employers in the world think that everybody needs to pay off their student loans. And some people do. Some people with really high incomes, you know, need to pay it off for sure. But this whole rule change in July is going to really throw things for a loop. Now, also, they're going to come out with new cancellation rules. Those cancellation rules are going to be super aggressive to the extent that they feel like they can get away with it. Meaning that I don't think they want to do another Supreme Court showdown necessarily. Maybe they do. I don't know. But they're going to go not super big. They're not going to go as big as they did before. But it kind of seems like what they're trying to figure out is how do they define a hardship? And then if they can define a hardship a certain way, they might be able to deliver a lot of cancellation for people that are undergoing hardship. TBD on what that's going to mean, but it's mostly probably going to affect people that have tons of like interest that's accumulated over the years and that's, I think, the biggest impact that we're going to see is just canceling like $10,000 to $20,000 of like accrued interest for people that would have qualified for the cancellation program in the first place. So that's what I think they'll probably try to do. Realistically, that will be announced and that cannot actually go into place until July 2025. What happens in January 2025? The Biden or somebody on the Republican side would be sworn in as president, right? January 2025 for a second term or someone in other term, right? So that's a big deal because if Biden's reelected, that 10 to 20,000 cancellation program of interest probably goes through. The SAVE plan's becoming the norm and the law of the land longer term, and that SAVE plan will probably be pretty baked in for how loans would operate at least until like 2030, which is like a long period of time, right? Now, if a Republican wins, then all bets are off. You might see another negotiated rulemaking committee formed. That rulemaking committee would very likely try to axe the SAVE plan. The only catch would be if Trump were to win, you know, instead of another Republican, maybe like 2016 to 2020, maybe Trump doesn't care about student loans. You know, he started the pause, right? So maybe he just ignores it. So those are the different scenarios that might happen in 2024. I will say I was listening to a podcast called Pod Save America. It's a podcast that's sort of leaning towards the Democratic Party. They were talking on that podcast about student loan cancellation and how some of the president's top surrogates are really frustrated that President Biden's done so much on student loans and hasn't gotten the commensurate amount of credit they would have expected in the polls for it. And they specifically talked about, like, they didn't say the words IDR account adjustment or IDR waiver, but they talked about that specific program being the way that he's canceled $130 billion of student loans out of the $1.7 trillion total. I just found that interesting. I like to listen to different types of political podcasts so that I can get a sense, just in case they ever talk about student loans, of, you know, what policy developments might occur. So I thought that was interesting because what that tells me is, and you think about why are student loans important for the White House reelection strategy, it's because any particular candidate's going to have a weakness, right? President Biden's is typically viewed as a turnout weakness among younger voters and younger voters of color, Gen Zers, right? And millennials. The student loan issue is kind of a proxy for how do I address my biggest weakness? I think the administration kind of views how do we be as aggressive as possible on this particular issue so that we can really increase and improve our support and our turnout among younger voters who we have to be able to win. Kind of interesting. Student loans, I think, are going to be more focused upon because it is truly one of President Biden's like largest achievements, both in like dollar impact and money spent and things that he's been able to get around Republican Congress and a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Not entirely. Obviously, cancellation was tossed, but he's accomplished an enormous amount given that conservative majority and frankly, adeptly dodged a lot of roadblocks that could have blocked most all of that cancellation just by doing super wonky policy things that the people on the Republican side of the education aisle aren't motivated enough to try to stop. When you do something very straightforward, like cancel, right, like, you know, flick of a pen, cancel $400 billion of debt. They understand that, but like these weird, policy wonkish things, like let's cancel 10 to 20,000 of accrued interest, but only for people in this income category. Like that's a little bit harder for them to get worked up upon and try to make a political movement out of stopping. So that's a little preview of what we'll expect here in 2024. Another thing I didn't mention is if you borrowed between 2007 and 2014, the pay plan's getting blocked for new entrants as of July 2024. That's a much bigger issue than most people think, particularly for dentists, veterinarians, lawyers, people that have a decently high income, typically a very increasing income, maybe faster than inflation. Professions like that really should be thinking about the pay plan versus the SAVE plan to shave off 5 years of extra payments at their highest income years. But people that borrowed between 2007 and 2014 are going to get blocked from signing up for pay after July 2024, and they're not going to have access to the new IBR plan, which is statutorily guaranteed to people who borrowed starting in July 2014 for the first time. So there's that going on. Double consolidation is very active and going on. IDR waiver is active and going on. Strategies about delaying taxes, filing separately, consolidating to try to get your IDR payment started sooner so that you get out of that in-school grace period faster. There's even strategies about applying at studentaid.gov/IDR while you're still enrolled in school for your Grad PLUS loans, essentially applying basically every 3 months to try to waive your deferment and get enrolled in the SAVE plan to get subsidies on those loans. When you graduate, you can consolidate those Grad Plus with the Staffords, which are required to be in school deferment while you're enrolled in school, whereas the Grad Pluses are not. And then you could get weighted average credit on the new consolidation, maybe come out of school with 1 to 2 years towards your forgiveness program instead of zero with a lot less interest. There's all kinds of ways to save money right now as a student loan borrower. If you need any of those ways, studentloanplanner.com/book. We'd love to help. And thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner Podcast.